It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know.
Hello, and welcome to the Great War Podcast, episode number 3, September through October 1914. Although the name will shortly be changed to the First World War Podcast. Okay, so let's catch up, shall we? It's mid-September 1914. The Russians have taken severe losses in Prussia thanks to Hindenburg and Ludendorff at Tannenberg. However, they have attacked from Poland into Austria-Hungary and pushed their enemy back to the Carpathians. Austria is just generally getting beat up by the Russians. They can't even take Serbia, as they have fought them to a standstill, and that's all they have done so far. Well, except for getting the ball rolling with the whole World War I thing. The Germans are racing north in France and Belgium, trying to outflank the French and British. In Prussia, they are watching the Austrians, wondering how long they can hold out. After all, they can't even seem to defeat Serbia. German submarines and commerce raiders are attacking British shipping and navy vessels. The British are reeling from their losses after the Great Retreat and are struggling to keep the Germans from outflanking them. On the British home front, the people are still very pro-war, even though they are starting to see the losses in men from the Great Retreat and the Battle of the Marne. The French are also tired, but have a much larger manpower reserve to pull from and can afford to take much higher losses. They are assisting the British in their efforts to outflank the Germans to the north. The Ottomans are eyeing the situation and casting around to see who will offer the better deal. Thanks to the British keeping a few dreadnoughts they were building for the Ottomans, and the Germans gifting the Ottomans with a few cruisers that were in the Mediterranean, they are leaning towards the Central Powers. This month I want to start by rewinding a bit to describe the war in the Pacific. You see, there was another nation watching the proceedings and carefully planning her own war 25 years later. We've talked about British colonies before, but one thing to remember is that everyone who had aspirations of being an empire had to have some colonies. The two places any young nation could start colonies were Africa and the Pacific. In 1897, two German missionaries were killed in China. In response, Germany demanded to be able to lease Chinese soil for a port and a military base. The Germans built the port of Tsingtao. The British were watching and considered the Germans a threat to their own Pacific colonies and leased and built their own port to counter them. Enter the Empire of Japan. Japan had been watching the Europeans and had put a lot of effort into modernizing itself in the preceding years. They had gone from wearing medieval armor and using bows and swords to having a modern armed forces in the last 50 years. In 1904 to 1905, the Japanese invaded and took Port Arthur from the Russians. They also defeated two modern Russian fleets. Yet the rest of the world would not take them seriously till the 1940s. After all, the Kaiser said, it would shame me more to surrender Tsingtao to the Japanese than Berlin to the Russians. And it would take the most horrific weapon ever invented to stop them in 1945. The British entered into an alliance with the Japanese to counter German and Russian encroachment in the Pacific. The British gave the nod to the Japanese to attack Tsingtao, and they declared war on the Central Powers on August 24th. On the 27th, a combined Japanese and British naval force blockaded the Germans in the port. The German fleet was out on routine missions as the war broke out and was unable to interfere. Most of the blockading fleet was made up of obsolete ships, but the Japanese did contribute a few modern dreadnoughts and a seaplane tender. The planes from the tender made the first naval launched air attacks when they attempted to bomb the German defenders. The Germans could only field two planes, but also made aviation history when one of their pilots claimed to have shot down another with his pistol. The Japanese landed their Marines and completed the encirclement. They dragged heavy guns up and started shelling the city in mid-October. The British also sent a 1,500-man land force to keep an eye on their ally. It appears they were starting to wonder about Japan's ambitions in the Pacific. The Germans fought well with what they had, but were forced to surrender on the morning of the 7th November 1914. The German POWs were treated well during the rest of the war, and over 100 of the 5,000 captured would choose to stay in Japan. The Japanese also snatched up the Mariana, Caroline, and Marshall Islands from the Germans with little difficulty. The remaining colonies, the British, New Zealanders, or Australians would snatch up within the first few weeks of the war, ending the German land presence in the Pacific. Now, for those of you out there who are wondering about Graf Spee and the Emden, we will get to that in a later podcast. France is on the move. They were almost defeated at Arras starting on the 25th of September. The French 10th Army attacked and managed to take Douai. Our old friend from last episode, Crown Prince Ruprecht, then counterattacked and pushed the French back to Arras. Both armies were reinforced, and they started leapfrogging each other only to come up against their enemy again. The BEF wound up in Belgium with their French allies to the south. The British Army, or the BEF, is fighting with the Germans up the Ain River. They are exhausted and have 13,000 casualties from the Battle of the Marne alone. That's out of an original 70,000 men that landed in France in August. Now, the Kaiser's troops had taken a Belgian city named Ypres on the 3rd of September. As the Allies battled their way back north, they eventually retook the city, and the Germans retreated, right to the high ground that surrounds the city. The BEF was trapped in a salient that extended into the German lines. They started digging their own defenses pretty quickly. So, I don't remember reading a British account from this area that doesn't talk about this. You see, this is the same area that had been fought over a few months ago. These men start to dig and find the bodies of their comrades from August. Yet what can you do? You can't drag them up over the parapet to bury or you'll get shot. You can't drag them back out of the trenches because that in itself is a danger. The Germans would target their artillery on trench crossroads for maximum casualties. Most soldiers elected to rebury them in the new trenches, only they were in the lowlands, remember? Most of them came back to surface when the water would erode the trenches. Then the trench would flood because of poor drainage, and you would have to dig some more to keep from being seen by the Germans. The remains of the Belgian army moved up and held the line to the north of the British. In this time frame, the temporary trenches that had been built started being deepened and expanded to better protect the soldiers. By the end of the year, you could walk from the coast in Belgium to Switzerland in a trench for the vast majority of the way. The opposing armies took a short breath before the Germans attacked on the 19th of October, but that will wait for next month. Horatio Kitchener was 64 years old in 1914. Kitchener volunteered with the French in the Franco-Prussian War to see some action, but was put out after catching pneumonia. He started his career in the BEF in 1871 as an engineer. Kitchener surveyed areas in Palestine, Egypt, and Cyprus before rising to fame by defeating a Muslim uprising in the Sudan. He also commanded in the Second Boer War and was a national hero to the British. Now, in 1914, he was the field marshal for the British, meaning that he was Sir John French's boss. His post was in more administrative, though. He organized one of the most memorable recruiting campaigns ever. Kitchener, at the beginning of the war, would claim to need 3 years and 1 million men to end it. Everyone thought he was crazy. On the British home front, meanwhile, people are just beginning to realize the scale of the carnage. The average British man was up to the task, though, and by the end of September 1914, over 750,000 men had signed up. The idea was to take the remains of the BEF and use them to train the incoming soldiers. They would not have much time, though, as reinforcements were needed badly. After this, the BEF is effectively no more as a unit. The old guard was used to salt the new recruits and form the new volunteer army after November. This sets up another great tragedy of the Great War. Young men were being signed up with the idea that they could serve together. Thus, when the adult male population of a village signs up, they all get to charge the machine guns together, with the result that some British villages would lose the majority of their male population in just a few hours. The Germans would try the idea at Langemark later in the month with college students. The results would be no less tragic. So, before we leave the Western Front for this month, let's look at another of these innovations in warfare that are coming of age. The Belgians in 1914, realizing how handy this new automobile was, thought, hey, let's weld some steel to this thing and add some machine guns. They did, and the result was the great-great-granddaddy of today's Bradley fighting vehicle. They used them as rescue vehicles and for scouting the enemy positions. The Western Front would now die down for a few days till everyone realized they weren't going anywhere. The Germans would start the first Battle of Ypres, or Langemark, as the Germans knew it, on the 19th of October. It would be the first battle designed not to outflank the enemy, but one designed to penetrate through his defenses and exploit that break in his line. Unfortunately, this model of fighting a battle requires a much larger sacrifice to exploit, as we will see for the next 4 years straight. Okay, so on to the Eastern Front. As we talked about earlier, the Germans were now giving their Austrian allies the stink eye over not being able to fight their way out of a wet paper bag. The Russians had pushed them back to the Carpathians, taking huge chunks of Austrian land. The Germans realized that if Austria fell, the Russians would have a straight shot to Berlin. To make matters worse, the Russians were still mobilizing their massive armies. The Germans learned of a Russian attack into German Silesia, so they sent their A-team in. Hindenburg and Ludendorff made a new army from units in Prussia and the Western Front. On the 29th of September, they launched an attack into Poland with the intent of taking Warsaw. The Austrians also launched an attack into Galicia in order to draw reinforcements off. The new 9th Army made good progress and by the 17th of October was just 12 miles away from Warsaw. This is where he learned of a Russian army crossing the Vistula behind him. Hindenburg and Ludendorff ordered the retreat while blowing up bridges behind them, and by early November were at their starting point. The Austrians, meanwhile, didn't want to quit with tradition, and were beaten by the Russians, yet again. The Serbians were still holding on, except for the toehold the Austrians had won across the river Drina. This area had developed into trench warfare, with the less well-equipped Serbians taking heavier losses. They just didn't have their artillery, and their manufacturing capacity was nil. Therefore, their guns fell silent fairly quickly. So, that's it for this month. Next time, we'll explore the Kindermord, or the First Battle of Ypres. Also, I bet that Team Hindenburg-Ludendorff is going to hang up the towel after retreating out of Poland, right? Thanks for listening. Randy Mark.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long